2012, 2013, it was like a physical product rollout, right? Now it's like a digital product rollout. And then that's just going to catch on like wildfire when friends and people see like, hey, you get all your time back on your Tesla and it's like super safe and you could just like be working while it's driving you around.
Well, what's the conversation when Tesla has 2 times the amount of vehicles that Waymo has in all these cities and they're growing? So not only did they catch up, but they're also moving the fastest compared to anyone else. Once they pass Waymo, I think that's when you'll actually start to see more recognition of stocks.
This is the tidbit of knowledge, nugget of knowledge that all of us in the Tesla bubble will have, that people who are smart in technology that are not part of the Tesla bubble don't have. They don't understand that Tesla can produce in a week what Waymo plans to have by the end of the year. And they don't understand that Tesla's cost like 25% of the cost of a Waymo, like to build, and Tesla's just gonna undercut them massively and they can just turn it on.
The best-selling car in the world, the Model Y, driving around Austin without someone behind the steering wheel and pedal, that has to do something, right? That has to be an aha moment that says, holy shit, the car that is doing paid rides right now in Austin, they sold 1 million of those last year. Okay, so what's going to happen to the stock? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I think
Okay.
I think that when this robotaxi goes live in Austin, it's going to lead to some viral videos, influencer type people, TikTok, YouTube, and I think that's going to help. That's going to be a good signal, like, hey, it's working. And then the stock may not react initially to that, or may, but I think as the summer goes on, I assume that they're going to open it up somewhere else, like in the summer or fall, the latest. But they'll open it up, whether it's in California or other Florida or other parts of Texas or something. Then I think more videos will go live, and like maybe they'll let people put their own Model Ys into the network. And I think demand is going to really like the wait times. The stock and the wait times are going to be correlated here. So keep a close eye on the wait times for Model Ys. And if those go up, that means the stock is going to be pretty close, going up pretty soon after that, in my opinion.
How does this differ from when you did your big sort of like the calls, the analysis you were doing around the company in like late the 2010s before that big run up in 2019, 2020? Like what are the similarities? What are the differences?
It feels similar in sort of like transforming the company to something new. Right now it's like a mammoth EV manufacturer and energy battery producer, and it's valued for more than that.
And actually, sorry, Emmett, before you keep going, maybe tell the audience, for those that are not familiar, what that was. Like what was the thesis back in during that time that you capitalized
In
on?
2010, 11, they were just kind of like this startup company that was, supposed to go bankrupt. And they had a couple of these like roadster, they had these Lotuses they kind of tricked out with batteries to sell the original roadster to people at like huge losses. They had raised a bunch of money, and so they're operating, on losses, and time's ticking for them to go bankrupt. And it's like a 1 or 2 billion market cap company at the time. But I got an early look at the Model S prototype, and that was the first electric vehicle built from the ground up by a new company, that's going to go to the market, mass market. And it was just so amazing. And I was like putting in a bunch of long-term options at the time, like with a play money account I had at the time, my tiny IRA account that I had on the side, and betting that this Model S would come to market and people would love it, and then they'd buy a lot of it and they'd start selling a lot. It'd be like a new car company that is not going to go bankrupt, And then by the time 2012, 2013 came around, it got Motor Trend Car of the Year when it first came out, and people started buying and loving, tons of reviews, viral videos on YouTube at the time were going, or reviews on forums. There wasn't a whole lot of YouTube like there is today, but there was like lots of forums, people writing about magazines, Motor Trend, some other magazines that were independent, not relying on advertising only. You could just tell that, like, man, this car is amazing. And I got my test drive in it later in the year, and I was buying a bunch of these call options with all the extra money I could. And then eventually, when they showed a profit, they said, we're not, this is the first quarter where we actually are cash flow positive. It was like the beginning of 2013, I think. then the stock just took off because there was such a huge, at that time it was different because there were so many shorts betting for the stock to go down to zero that they all had to cover. So the stock went from like, at the time, you know, this was many splits before, it was like two or three split, you know, it split to two or three times. So it's not corresponding today, but at the time it was like $30, but it zoomed up to like $120 really quickly. And then up to like 250 soon after that, even. So it's not going to go up like tenfold like that. You know, that was a short squeeze when you could, shorts could manipulate a 1 billion market cap stock easily, you know, but they can't manipulate a 500 billion market cap stock like Tesla is right now, or 700 billion, whatever. So I think right now you're just going to get a new investment thesis on Tesla, and it might go up like 3 or 4x within a year or two of, is my guess, if I had to guess. You know, I'm just, this is not investment advice. It's just what I've observed. There's another thing like this in 2018.
Oh, this whole time I thought it was investment advice, Evan. What the hell?
Well, there was.
Thank you to the sponsor of this podcast, Rebellionaire. Rebellionaire is an investment firm that gets Tesla investors. We know a lot of you are Tesla investors and you watch this channel to learn more about the company, learn more about Elon Musk and what he's doing. But Rebellionaire is unique because they're not just like any other firm where they might be hesitant to bring on people like yourself that might have an outsized Tesla position or are huge believers in one story like Tesla. Usually you'll get the cold shoulder from these guys, but Rebellionaire is different. They understand and they work for you to really succeed with the plan you have while having an outsized Tesla position. They do very unique research around the company. They do cross-country FSD trips. They have very innovative ways of tracking things like the energy sector of the company. They're just very unique in their approach and understand investors that would be interested in companies like Tesla.
And one of the reasons why they understand investors like you is because they are investors like you. Matt Smith and Bradford Ferguson are retail shareholders of Tesla themselves. And so not only are they registered financial advisors, but they also understand this specific type of retail investor strategy very well. Plus, as registered financial advisors, they understand the more complicated strategies that a lot of times are a little bit more difficult for retail investors to understand. Great strategies around offering covered calls or trimming and adding Tesla positions to help you really maximize your long-term value from your outsized Tesla position.
And so if that's something that's interesting to you, go out and check them out at rebellionaire.com/Farzad, rebellionaire.com/Farzad. And that way they'll know that we sent you. Now back to the podcast.
There was another play like this in 2019, 2020 too. And as you all probably are keenly experienced as well. And so this is like the next transformation, you know, of the Tesla investment thesis about to happen, in my opinion.
Okay. Yeah, I think from my perspective, if I think back to those two giant runs, 2013 and 2019, 2020, it was the market, once they saw, from my perspective, you guys tell me if you read this incorrectly, from my perspective is the market was just waiting to see proof in the P&L for that next leg. So 2013 was, okay, profitable company, great. 2019, 2020 was, okay, profitable at scale, great. And then now with this robotaxi one, I wonder if the way the market's going to price it is going to be similar to, you know, is it on Tesla to show the robotaxi profitability, the cash flow machine, the scalability, the low running costs versus the competition, the different levers they can pull from a like a viral marketing perspective, from an adoption perspective, from selling the cars to customers and the customers becoming like part of the product and quote unquote selling the vehicles to riders, yeah. Right? Is that going to show up in the P&L? Do you think it takes that sort of recognition by the market, or do you think now it's more of a like the market just needs to see that the technology works because the scale is obvious? Like if one Model Y, or like if a fleet of 10 to 20 Model Ys in Austin can safely deliver driverless rides that would be the same or more per vehicle than Waymo, then it's just a math exercise of, okay, Tesla just has way more cars in the fleet, right? So they're going to be able to do a lot more. Like, I'm curious to see where your head is at.
Yeah, I think that's our like green light. That's my green light to be like, my signal to be like, all right, I need to go heavier on long-term options or something like that. Personally, you know, I have a lot of stock. I bought some long-term call options personally recently, but not a lot. But I have a small fund I run, which is most of my aggressive stuff. And that's like always been long term, a lot like focused on heavy long term options. So that'll do well, too. But I think that, like you said, like when you see the small amount of proof of in the pudding, like Austin experiment go well, that's like my signal or my green light to be like, OK, I should go a little heavier now in the long term call options, because the market has a delay often, like you said, like they need to see the P&L on the balance sheet and the quarterly earnings for one or two quarters maybe before it really explodes. So that could not be, that might not be till, it could take a whole year if it's a slow rollout. But if you see it successfully in Austin and then it's not until like, you know, the late fall when they do it somewhere else, like in California, and then it's not until like next spring when they do it in Florida or whatever, then that's a slower rollout I would, the slowest rollout I would expect. But in that case, it could be a full like year before it really shows up materially on a couple of earnings reports in a row where the Wall Street then is like, crap, this is going to displace Waymo. And this is the leader of robotaxi, you know, regardless, you know. So that's my thought. I mean, maybe that Wall Street and institutions and institutional money is smarter than it has been. But in my opinion, it might have to show up on the bottom line in some earnings reports, just because the macro market is so index heavy these days. All the money in the market is like, so much of it is passive investment in indices and ETFs now. And so you need, I think, a good amount of actual portfolio managers that are picking stocks to like recognize this and go in to like really bump the stock up a lot.
Go for it, Hans.
Yeah, Emmett, how are you thinking about the difference between, you know, these types of scenarios? It may be like there's a lot more uncertainty around the timeline. Is it happening fast? Is it happening slow? Both from a technology rollout perspective and then also from a market recognition perspective. How's that different or similar to some of the other, scenarios in the past? Maybe it's similar-ish to 2012, 2013, but maybe not similar to, S&P inclusion in 2019, 2020?
Yeah, it's a good point. 2012, 2013, it was like a physical product rollout, right? Now it's like a digital product rollout, you know, so it's different in that with the flip of a switch, they can upload it to all Model Ys theoretically if they wanted to. I don't think they'll do that. I think it'll be robotaxi, at least, will be rolled out in certain regions very carefully because they don't want to mess that up. So I'm hoping like every couple months there'll be a new city or something, and not like every year. That would be that would suck if it's like once a year a new city's added. You know, I doubt that. So I think it'll be, if it's successful in Austin, I'm hoping later in the summer, somewhere in California, like they've signaled, you know, and then maybe Florida and other places late end of the year. But you never know how fast they will roll it out, this digital product. They could roll it out. And then the other product, though, sort of, that's like the intermediary between where we are now and the robotaxi, which is, I think, going to add a lot of confidence and make the demand. This is where I was saying the demand is going to go up a lot, because not only are fleet managers going to start speculating and starting businesses and buying some Model Ys earlier, more materialistically, like just start accumulating in them, speculatively. But I think there's going to be the unsupervised full self-driving will be the intermediary that's allowed for people who have Tesla insurance and the newest Hardware 4. You know, you'll be able to get the unsupervised full self-driving on your car. You know, you're still going to have to sit in the car, but at least you won't have that annoying camera looking at you. You'll be able to, like, text or whatever, you know, and then that's just going to catch on like wildfire when friends and people see like, hey, you get all your time back on your Tesla and it's like super safe and you can just like be working while it's driving you around. And if you have Tesla insurance, it's allowed, you know, and it's not going to be part of a robotaxi network per se. It's just going to be your personal. I think that's going to be an intermediary, however brief that may be, but until it's robotaxis everywhere. What do you guys think about that?
I mean, I think that's the very interesting piece of it that I've been thinking through, because I thought that was going to happen with the supervised FSD portion. I thought that, you know, it would go crazy viral and people would 1,000% jump on the bandwagon of buying Teslas and subscribing to FSD when they see that I don't have to do anything. And effectively, with Hardware 4, Model 3s and Model Ys, that's basically true. I mean, that's basically true. But it does seem like people just want their time. I think the true virality is like, I want to look at my phone. I want to look at my phone. I want to take a nap. I want to watch Netflix on the screen. I want to, you know, whatever. Yeah. I want to do whatever. That at that point is not just like, wow, look at how incredible this is. How obvious is it going to be that it's going to go unsupervised? It's like, wow, I can do this now. Right? I can do this now. And then there's going to be a comparison thing that says, okay, do I want to buy a car that starts at, you know, the Model Y with the EV tax credit is $37,500 now, well, the cheapest one. Do I want to buy a RAV4 for $35,000 or $33,000 or, and I have to drive? Or do I buy a Model Y for $37,500 and then I don't have to drive?
Yep.
At that point, not only do you not have to drive, you can literally do whatever you want.
Yeah, you literally have like a chauffeur now. You don't have to pay attention to the road. Yeah. You don't have to look at the road. You can look wherever you want. Yeah.
That can become a cash flow generating machine for you personally if you add it to the fleet as well, right? So I wonder if that value proposition clicks and it becomes like mainstream, right? Go ahead, Hans, I see you're off mute.
I was just wondering what the data that Tesla sees on, you know, when they give out the free trials to people on version 13, what the conversion rate is to then subscribe if they've ever had a cell phone strikeout. Like, that's my guess, is that people try it and then they get spanked for trying to use a cell phone one time. And they're like, nah, this product is not worth anything to me right now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe that changes as soon as Elon and the team actually allow you to be able to, you know, do a little bit of texting.
Let's bring in Nico into the conversation. What's what are you thinking through?
Just listening to the genius Emmett. He's the GOAT. I don't care what he's going to say to sound humble. He's the GOAT.
thank you very much. I'm fortunate in a lot of ways, but thank you.
I mean, as are we, to be able to listen to your point of view. All right, I'll get off my knees. Don't worry, Farzad.
I was going to say, like, I was, what are you all doing, bro? Like, this is a PG-13 show. Like, my God. He's married, you know.
Yeah, I know. So, yeah, I guess taking it back to the top about, you know, the stock itself, I'm kind of in alignment with Emmett. I kind of think the Robotaxi event will more or less be a non-event for the stock, at least in the way that I think a lot of people are thinking. I know a lot of people are thinking 400, 500, 600. We were just there right after the election. We can do there again. I would hedge against that. Or no, poor choice of words. I would not put all my chips in on that happening. If you just think back, and I'm always the one that says that I don't like to use history to determine what's going to happen in the future, but anytime the stock has actually moved, it had nothing to do with the Cybertruck finally going to production. It had nothing to do with Berlin and Austin finally coming online. It had nothing to do with the S and X refresh. Like, none of these things are what moved it. Like, before the election, which that one, it didn't even move from We Robot Day. It moved after the election happened, you know? And before that, the big move we had was this random Hertz announcement of 100 vehicles. Like, these things that were just so like, what? That's what gets the stock excited?
100,000.
Okay, 100,000. That never came to fruition. And in that same day, Elon said, we've had no conversation with Hertz or anything, right? So the stock, I don't think, normally moves because of these events. I think what Emma said was right. Like, it takes Wall Street a little bit to really, like, understand what's going on. And I think that I do think we could see like 300s, 400s, you know, around June, July, that time frame. But I just don't think we're going to see that big move that everyone's been talking about. Now, as far as how it happens, I think it just happens gradually over time. And it's going to be one of those things where it's like, oh, man, it just keeps running, just keeps running, just keeps running. But I don't think I know as far as you and I have had tension on this. I don't think you need to see revenue on the P&L in the terms of crazy gross margins. I think all you need to do is see Tesla go from Austin to another city that's not San Fran, right? Just show what that rollout looks like, because that'll tell us a lot. That'll show kind of what the pace is. And have more vehicles in Austin or San Fran, et cetera, than Waymo has? Because at that point, the question is, who can compete with Tesla? Up to this point, it's been, hey, they don't have LiDAR, or Waymo's already doing it, Tesla's not doing it. Well, what's the conversation when Tesla has two times the amount of vehicles that Waymo has in all these cities, and they're growing? So not only did they catch up, but they're also moving the fastest compared to anyone else. So even if Toyota or someone else does come up with full self-driving somehow, well, how do you catch up when Tesla's already out there deploying, driving costs down, gaining the scale first? To me, it's game, set, match once you can see that. And so once they pass Waymo, I think that's when you'll actually start to see more recognition of stock. And I don't think you actually need to see revenue hit the bottom line. And I think that has a flywheel effect. In all these tech companies, we love talking about flywheel effects, what feeds back into it. And every time someone gets in a robotaxi and they find out, I can have this in my car, I can do this in my car, that increases demand. Once people don't have to, like everyone I've talked to who doesn't use FSD and has a Tesla, it's because, well, okay, I don't drive, but like, then what do I do? Like, it shows me how addictive phones really are. Everyone says like, yeah, if I could work, if I could be on my phone, different story. I even have a friend who would never buy a Tesla at all. But he said to me, yeah, if I didn't have to do anything, I could just work while I'm driving. And he's a road warrior. He'd be like, yeah, I'd get a Tesla. So I think that flywheel effect really starts to take into effect as we see that this actually rolls out and we start seeing it expand. We surpass Waymo. And then I think the stock follows. But I hope I'm wrong. Honestly, the stock will probably go 300 plus now just because I said this. But I think that it's going to be, I don't know. I normally think the contrarian viewpoint is the right viewpoint.
I think that's very interesting. And like, if you really think about how much does it take for Tesla to supersede Waymo, Waymo has 1500 cars. Tesla makes that in like 5 hours, right? So in theory, if they can have more than 1500 cars operational, right? Like they can do that. Like they could theoretically launch with 1500 cars in Austin. Waymo is limited by how many cars they have. Like, I don't think people understand this. Like, and they're limited by the cars they have because of the technology they're using, and they're outsourcing it to a player, and the HD maps that they have going on takes forever to map the regions they're going to launch in, right? It's more a function of, like, they're limited by production. And of course, like, safety is another lever that you have to make sure you're doing it right, you're not killing people, et cetera, et cetera. But even if their system was the safest in the world, they only have 1,500 cars.
But Farza, didn't you know they're going to add 2,000 whole more cars next year?
That's incredible. That's more than a 100% increase. The Google stock should go up a million.
This is the tidbit of knowledge, nugget of knowledge that all of us in the Tesla bubble will have, that people who are smart in technology that are not part of the Tesla bubble don't have. You talk to other people that are smart in like all kinds of other ways with AI or whatever. They're not in the Tesla bubble like we are. They think, oh, Waymo, what about Waymo? They're already first. They don't understand that Tesla can produce in a week what Waymo plans to have by the end of the year. And they don't understand that Tesla's cost like 25% of the cost of a Waymo, like to build, and Tesla's just going to undercut them massively and they can just turn it on. They don't understand those pieces of tidbits of knowledge. That's our differentiator. That's why we're going to be right and everyone else is going to be late to the party, in my opinion.
Okay, so does Wall Street understand this, right? Because that's my next question, is because if you look at Q1 deliveries, right? I see Nick shaking his head no, but this is where I'm going to be a little contrarian here, maybe. Is if you look at Q1 deliveries and their earnings, it was awful. It was awful. Stock did the opposite. Stock went up, right? So in my head, I'm like, okay, if you're valuing the company at $700 billion plus, knowing that Q1 was bad, there's potential brand damage, Elon is distracted, this is their narrative, right? And then sales might be down this year. Why else would you value the company at $700 billion plus and the stock's going up? There has to be something there. So if that assumption is correct, then anything... Now to Nick's point, to anything that would lead to Tesla being able to turn on the fleet points to the valuation, then catching up to that thesis, that long-term thesis, if they're willing to value this much now, right? So, or they're already made the assumption that, yeah, Tesla, of course Tesla's going to beat Waymo. Of course they're going to beat Waymo. It's $700 billion, right? But like, if that was the case, then the stock wouldn't be doing what it's doing after Q1 deliveries, right? So I don't know. I don't know what you guys think about that, because it's like, I now feel like Wall Street has woken up. I feel like Wall Street knows what's going on, because otherwise we wouldn't see the price action we've seen.
I think it's like a spectrum, right? And you have the people that study the stock carefully enough, like us in the bubble, and over here in the spectrum, that's enough of Wall Street to keep the stock valued where it is now.
It's the spectrum where we're all in the spectrum.
It's going to grow over time, you know, and when Austin happened, like a lot of people in this part, even though they study the stock, they don't quite trust, like it's a gray area. Like, well, theoretically, Tesla could be this robotaxi they're talking about for 10 years. I haven't done it yet. I don't quite get how they're going to roll it out with regulations, or, you know, there's going to be some hurdles. Let's just all believe when I see it kind of thing. And so when it happens in Austin, that's going to expand the spectrum a little more. When it happens somewhere else outside of San Francisco and Austin, like Nick said, it'll expand it even more. And then when it's happening everywhere, all of Wall Street's going to get on board like, holy crap, even though Tesla's, you know, quarterly earnings is, you know, their gross margin improved and their quarterly earnings are, you know, maybe double what it is now because of, but they see the writing on the wall clearly. And then the stock's going to be like overshoot, you know, and who knows, it could overshoot to like, you know, 5 trillion market cap. And then people are like, well, that's too expensive. And then be stuck between 3 and 5 trillion for the next 5 years until humanoids really ramp up, you know? So that's sort of the history. It seems to overshoot and then seem wildly expensive for the new investment thesis already. And people are like, oh, that's a short, no way it should be 5 trillion market cap. But people don't understand the humanoid robot at that point yet, you know? So that seems to be what could happen to me, in my opinion.
Yeah, as far as Wall Street goes, the reason I shook my head is I think sitting here at 287 at the moment is not because there is no Wall Street investors in the stock who believe in what is going to happen, who understand. And I guess it also depends what you mean by Wall Street. But if we use just the most broad, you know, anyone who's not individual retail, let's call that Wall Street. You know, Ron Barron, he understands this, he knows this, but he's not selling. So the question is, and Kathy Wood, same thing. The question is, does Wall Street get this for us to get this big move? And that's the part where I'm saying, no, they don't yet. The Wall Street people who believe in it and get it, they're already in it. They're you know, trading in and out, you know, hedging, selling some cover calls, maybe buying back. They're moving around. They're doing some things on the edges, but they essentially get what's the potential is. And then there's also probably a handful that say, well, I don't really believe in this, but it's down 50% from what it was just not too long ago. And that's compelling enough. But I don't think...
And then there's Ross Gerber.
Yeah, exactly. But when you have two earning calls in a row where I think, what was it, Jonas, who asked about LiDAR, he fundamentally doesn't get it still. He still doesn't get it. Like, it's I don't like it seems so obvious to us. Like, this is not a visual problem. It's a brain problem. And he can't grasp that.
Yeah. There's like half of Wall Street, at least, that they're smart in lots of other ways, but they don't get it. Like you said, like, I remember a few years ago, there's this lady, I can't remember her name, but she's like well-known, going on podcasts, talking about NVIDIA and all these things. And she sounded smart. And I listened. And then she talked about Tesla, and she's like, they're never going to get to full self-driving until they have like, you know, the next gen internet connectivity to their cars to help make the real-time decisions. And I'm like, this lady does not fundamentally understand. She's talking like she's an expert on this podcast that's accepting her as an expert on technology. And I called her on social media. She blocked me immediately, but everyone was like, this lady is nuts. And like, there's so many people at Wall Street that just don't understand the technology. They think they do, they don't. And they also don't understand the tidbits of knowledge that differentiates them from Waymo, like we were just talking about. People in the bubble do, but yeah, there's, like you said, such a huge swath of Wall Street doesn't get it yet. And they'll be forced to get it when they see it, you know, out competing Waymo in San Francisco and opening up another city and rolling out to other places successfully.
Okay, so here's the question. What percentage of all the money that could be in Tesla falls in that bucket that you just described? Of all potential investors.
It's similar to what potential of consumers should be buying Teslas but are not informed enough to buy Teslas, in my opinion.
Wow, okay, so a lot. So your thesis is that Tesla's current $700 billion valuation is still with the majority of the investing base that fundamentally do not understand what Tesla
has. That's right. Yeah, we're in our bubble. That's your thesis. We fundamentally understand. We overstudy it. We're in our bubble. Like, we understand it. But you talk to anyone outside our bubble, outside of people that use X regularly and see Tesla stuff on X, or don't, people who don't watch Elon's interviews. These are the type of people that, you know, they don't understand Elon. You know, they don't get it. It takes some study. Like, you have to be curious, I think, about the technology to sort of get it. If you're not curious enough, you're not going to be passionate enough to learn about it and figure it out.
We're also bad, like, just to look in the mirror a little bit, maybe with the exception of Emmett, we're also bad on timing when it comes to Tesla. We get a little too, oh, it's going to happen now, whatever. And, you know, you hear all these people about throwing leaps or whatever. And here we are 5 years later, stock hasn't really moved.
Oh, I make mistakes on timing all the time too. I've mistimed this, but you know what? You just time it one time right, you get 20 times your return. The other five times or seven times you got it wrong, you lost 100. But the one time you get it 20 times, worth it, you know? So I feel like strongly that this next 1 to 2 years, like, I'm looking at the call, you know, people always ask me, like, what options, and this is not investment advice, but personally, my personal kind of liquidity event recently, paid crap load of taxes, which sucked, but with the cash left over while I'm waiting to pay taxes, I bought a bunch of 600 June 2027 calls. So it's like more than enough 2 years, you know, and I expect to 10X that at least, you know, I that's what I'm expecting. That's my 50-50 over under, is to get a 10X on that. Maybe a 50X if it goes to 2000 or whatever, you know, or beyond. But I expect to get a very profitable return on that investment. But that's not investment advice, just like money. I'm willing to lose all of it if I'm wrong, obviously. But I like the odds of that one, for example.
And I think, so before we move on, Farzad, it is important to remember that since S&P inclusion, there's a lot of passive money that's just in the name, that, you know, it's kind of immaterial whether they have belief or non-belief, like, it's just in the index. And, you know, that's a fundamentally different stock movement dynamic than existed all throughout the early history of the company. From
it adds a lot of liquidity,
when they IPO'd.
It makes it harder to short immaterially. Yep. Yeah.
That's a good point.
So, okay. So how, you know, we're talking about like potential catalysts in the coming month or so with the robotaxi launch. We think Wall Street's not going to capture it, but I want to run this scenario here. And I wonder if this kind of like, is this the unlock, you know, that if the thesis is the majority of money that could be in Tesla is not in Tesla because they fundamentally do not understand the technology. What does having the best selling car in the world, the Model Y, driving around Austin without someone behind the steering wheel and pedal, that has to do something, right? That has to be an aha moment that says, holy shit, the car that is doing paid rides right now in Austin, they sold 1 million of those last year.
That's going to be right? An aha moment. Isn't, for Austin or a bubble.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure. It'll
come
be
on.
You'll have some influencers making, and by the way, let me just correct what I said. It's not harder to short. It's hard to successfully manipulate the stock to go down when it's in the index, you know, like, unlike in the past, shorts.
Yeah, there's no like physical blockades.
Yeah.
It's just that there's so much.
I just want to correct that because people will be like, oh, you said it's harder to start. But for what you're.
They're coming after you anyway, Emmett. It doesn't matter what you say.
Well,
they're coming after
you. But what you're saying, I think the real aha moment is going to be like for new consumers to really ramp up demand, especially. Is when they see the influencer TikTok videos of people putting their own Model Y into the robotaxi and explaining, hey, I'm making $100 today when I was on vacation. Just my car is out there making money for me. And it's explained in a 5-second TikTok video because people have no attention span, you know?
Especially if I'm on vacation and instead of my car actually, you know, racking up parking bills at the airport, it's just going to work all week while I'm gone and make me money. It's going to pay for my vacation.
Yeah. Imagine the TikTok videos. It'll be like 10 seconds and like explain it better than any of us can to all the other people out there, you know?
Yeah. Instead of drop shipping, it's going to be about FSD and putting it into the network.
Yeah.
That's a great point. I mean, I do see, you know, it's funny you say that, but like, I can't tell you how many YouTube videos I've seen because I was trying to study like how much people make off of Uber to try and get a good understanding of like the dollar per mile and how much yanking the driver, you know, how much of that is part of the equation. a taxi service, a ride hail service. And there are so many videos of people posting, this is how much I made on Uber. This is how I make more money on Uber. You know, my day to day on Uber. It's like a whole ecosystem of like people like, but now you're so right. Like the impact of having a, like those same people potentially, because, you know, a lot of them are going to have Teslas, right? Tesla is one of the most common cars, if not the most common car on the Uber platform in a lot of cities. It's going to be the same exact thing. This is how much I made on my Tesla while I was cooking eggs. This is how much I made on my Tesla while, you know, we were playing Grand Theft Auto 6.
I'm on vacation. Or whatever, right? You know, I own two Teslas and they go to work and they pay for my vacation. I'm on vacation. I come back, I have extra money even, you know?
Yeah. And that's the Airbnb model that Elon likes to plug all the time. Right, it's like he always says, it's like a mixture of Airbnb and what was the other example he used? Airbnb and something
Uber.
Else. But that's literally what people Uber. Perfect. Yeah, it's that. That's literally what how people make additional money with their properties is they list it on Airbnb and then they make money. That's how it works. They rent out a room. They rent out two rooms. They rent out the house, etc., etc. Now people are gonna, you know, people do that with to an extent with Turo. Turo is kind of like that for cars. But you still have to physically drop off the car, and the person still has to physically drive the car, right? There's still a human component to it on both sides. Whereas with a truly robotaxi network where anybody can add their car to the fleet, you're yanking the human component, and the friction gets completely removed to add vehicles to the fleet and make some money while you do literally nothing. Truly passive income. At that point, right? Outside of cleaning the car. But if Tesla offers a way for you to like pay him an extra $5 and they clean it for you or whatever, that could be a line item, you know? So, that's the one thing that I can't, like, you know, it's hard for me to believe that people that are outside of the bubble, if Tesla successfully launches unsupervised in Austin with no one behind the steering wheel and pedal with the best-selling car in the world, it's hard for me to believe that people outside of the bubble won't be like, wait a second, what just happened? Like, how is that possible? Like, that can't be, that's not like a seven-layer deep analysis of what's happening. It's like, wow, the car that I see everywhere doesn't have a driver anymore. Whoa. Like, that has to get something going, right? It's like, something has to happen, you know? But I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay, who wants to jump in?
Nico wants to talk about options.
Oh, no.
Go.
I was asking if that was a topic that we were talking about today, because I thought that was the why you wanted to have this conversation.
Let's talk about whatever.
Yeah.
How long do y'all have? I mean, can we go another half hour?
Yeah, I got a half hour. I didn't know if there was like certain topics you want to bring up regarding options, because that's a very big topic.
Do we
look
like people that know what they're doing, bro? Come on.
I don't know.
This is something I talk about nonstop, so... Yeah.
Go for it.
I don't know where to start, because
Emmett likes leaps, and Nico, what are you thinking about, like, how are you thinking about playing options as it, you know, this story unfolds over the next 6 to 12 months?
So I think options get a very bad rap for a very good reason. So let's start there. I think options are an amazing tool that I hate to say this, but I think that the majority of people don't use correctly and they lose money and then it gets a bad rap. And they are riskier than a stock 100%. Like, it's not even a question. Options are way riskier. But they can also give you way higher probabilities of profits or way higher returns. So there's with every give, there's a take. So I use options in several different ways. For example, before earnings, I bought a bunch of puts with the intention of losing that money. I had the puts that would expire 2 days later, because I didn't know what was going to happen. I was expecting a bad earnings call. And the way I thought about it is I might as well have some protection down here. It's a kind of a bet. And I'd rather have it than not. That's one way I use options. Another way is, as we've been coming down and selling off, I've been buying leaps out into 2026, 2027. Again, those are kind of like what Emmett was talking about. Positions that I'm okay with that I lose that money. If it happens, it happens. Those are you know, longer term bets. And I would say that's what they are, bets. And then there's another aspect of how I would say the majority of what I do with options is, which is where I just try to be very capital efficient in my portfolio. And what that means is I don't just sit here in stock and that's it and hope I do well. I will sell calls against my portfolio. I will sell puts against my portfolio. I do a lot of selling. I sell a lot of options to be capital efficient. And I leverage my portfolio to be able to do that. It's not always against Tesla. I literally sell puts and calls against everything. But that allows me to be a lot more capital efficient while I wait for Tesla to do something. And in the meantime, I generate revenue. And that revenue, I'm able to, again, flywheel effect, feed back into, hey, let's buy these Tesla Leaps because, well, I made this money selling options and it's kind of feeding itself. So what I'm doing right now is I actually do have some covered calls right now on Tesla. They're weekly covered calls. Again, this is probably going to be the last week I put any covered calls on Tesla because I want to ride through June and I don't want to get my face ripped off. I kind of just been doing weeklies and rolling out. In other words, rolling out is just closing and then reestablishing. But every time I do that, I'm creating a bigger and bigger buffer for myself because I'm collecting more premium. And so at this point, this will probably be the last week I do that just to protect from a big face ripper move up, which I don't think is going to happen, but it's probably going to happen because I don't think it's going to happen. So I don't want that to happen. And I have Leaps. I've been buying Leaps for, I guess, the last like 4 months since January. I've been buying Leaps since January. Since we've been coming down, I've been buying Leaps. And so I'm kind of thinking that I want to see how this Austin rollout goes. And as I see that rollout and I watch what the stock's doing, I think I'm going to have my own opinion on where I think the stock should be or if it's just slightly lagging. And at that point, I might try to be a little more aggressive with call options, which again, it's not my bread and butter. You know, I probably do something like 300 to 400 trades a month. And most of those are not buying calls or puts. It's selling. But I think I'm getting to a position where, you know, I hope to one day have an Emmett moment where I was smart enough, had the right time. Sure, some of those I might lose on, but you're able to have that big moment. But I think that's going to come not in June or July. I think I'll be sometime in the fall where it'll be the right time to put those positions on. But it's going to be my decision will purely be based on where's the stock at, how is the rollout going, are there issues, are they scaling, and trying to, you know, capitalize on any alpha that there might be there. So hopefully that's a big broad stroke. So I don't know if that helps or if you want to go anywhere with that.
I'm curious what the options master has to say about Nick's positioning.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I'm just trying to pull up the probability lab for Interactive Brokers on Tesla stock for the next couple of years so you can kind of see. But for me, I've never been that successful selling covered calls. I've experimented with that. I've sold some puts, done all right and done not so well sometimes. My big wins have been buying calls, you know, and that's what I know, like for asymmetrical opportunities like these Tesla jumps where it transforms to a new business. Wall Street has to revalue it for something completely different suddenly. And so that's like sort of like the advantage we have in our tidbits of knowledge that no one outside the bubble seems to have, in that they're about to transform into this like robo-taxi behemoth and transform transportation forever. And so for me, I'm looking like, for example, right now, June 2027, that's like the conservative 2 years. That's a long time, you know? And so that's conservative time frame for where we're at now and what's about to happen. And the probability, the 50-50 Wall Street probability is like, these numbers are so small, kind of sucks, but I think it's like close to $300, or no, it's even less. It's like 250. Oh my gosh, it's 50-50. Like that's the 50-50 line. Wall Street, the options are pricing Tesla to be at $250 in June 2027. To me, that's ridiculous. And if you go to like 500 or 600 where I bought mine, it's like less than a 10% chance that Wall Street thinks it'll be it'll have doubled from where it is today by June 2027. To me, that I think it's more like 80 to 90% chance it's going to like way more than double between now and June 2027. So to me, that's a total mispricing, almost like an arbitrage opportunity of knowledge that I can cash in on and buy some long-term options and just like print money for myself. It's like a cheat code for freak, just like wealth, you know, to me. I could be wrong, and that's why I have it in, when I do that type of trade, it's like money I'm willing to lose because if I'm 10 or 20% wrong, I lose all of it, you know? But to me, it seems like a no-brainer. The easiest way for me to generate more wealth is to do something like that 2 years out. If you try to time it like 1 month or 2 months, it's fun to like watch the market and I get itchy and I want to press buttons to plate the trade. Because every time I place a trade, I get like a dopamine hit. And if I close out a profit, I get a dopamine hit, you know? And
you're an addict.
So if I have to be mindful of that and not do that because it hasn't been my successful return, you know? My successful return has been like those long-term options and waiting for it to play out. And then I'll get those big dopamine hits when the stock's like rallying like crazy. And I'm like, I have to make sure I don't close it out too early because the stock's still rallying. I still think I have a target in mind. And then, you know, again, the thing with the options and playing it right is you have to also put a plan in place. Like, all right, if it gets to this price, I'm going to sell half of my position, not all of it. You know, I don't have to close it all out if I buy long-term call options that are suddenly doing really well. And I don't have to, and I shouldn't hold on to all of it because when it overshoots, if I can sell half of it at the top, that's amazing. You know, let's say that happens and then it comes back down, you know, so you just have to have a kind of a plan of like, okay, I'm gonna have this time period. If the stock doubles or triples, if my options become worth like five times where it is now, I'm going to sell half. So I lock in a nice profit and let the other half run, you know, that kind of thing I think helps a lot for the anxiety with seeing, you know, your P&L go up and down while you're just sitting on your hands waiting, you know?
Yeah, I would add, I've covered calls on Tesla right now, but that to be clear, like most of the trading I do is not on Tesla. Most of what I do is on anything that's got high volatility. It's really all I care about. But there's two different lenses to look at whenever you're doing this. Like to me, the reason I like selling options a lot is because Emmett's trying to beat the market right now with what he's talking about, right? And any of us who are buying leaps or buying call options, we're trying to beat the market. We're trying to beat the market by a certain amount, by a certain date, right? That's what it means.
Yeah.
However, on the other side of it, when I'm selling options, the market has to beat me. I don't have to beat the market. I don't have to be right on time. I don't have to be right on price. I just have to say, well, you have to get here. And if you get there, all right, then I lose, but you have to get there. And I can see what the odds are of you getting there. And I can see what it is based on volatility and time. And every day it doesn't get there, I'm slowly winning. And I think that's a very good method for capital efficiency. But for what we're talking about, what everybody in Tesla community thinks is going to happen eventually with Tesla, where we're going to have these big runs, it does you no good to do that because your upside's capped. Whereas what Emmett's saying, it's uncapped. So just saying that there's two different lens here. I obviously also have leaps, so I'm also looking to time and, you know, get that big up move. But I just want to at least make those two distinctions that there are differences and depends on what you expect. You know, yeah. Like if I'm looking at, Palantir or Nvidia or, I don't know, AppLovin today had a huge rip. It's a great time, in my opinion, to sell calls against it because you can get way ahead of the money on that up move. And odds are that big up move, we're talking about like 10% on Meta. We're seeing 8% on Palantir. Like you could probably sell a 160 on Palantir for the end of the month and make, you know, a couple grand easy, you know? And so, but that's a shorter time period versus also looking at a longer time period. We're talking about like 45 days to expiration. We're talking about proper strategy management, meaning when you sell, if I receive $1,000, I'm going to get out at the latest when I made 50% profit because I'm not going to risk my $500 for another 500. Like that doesn't math. But with buying, it's essentially exponential. So this is where I just say like it's important to understand the nuances and differences here. And
Yeah.
Understand the game that you're playing.
Yeah.
And it's also said, like, I think that's very valid to do that. I was doing that with, I had like a basket of some other stocks in another account. A wealth manager was managing for me and doing covered calls on like a basket of the NVIDIA, Google, Meta. And it was selling covered calls monthly for a year, the last year. And it did all right. I mean, the whole market went up at the same time. So it did as well as if I just held the stock, you know, but it can do better long term. Like if I kept it for the last few months going, it might have improved, but I liquidated that account. But it did good. It's a good way to generate income, like you said, almost passive income. And if the market shoots up past your calls, you can buy your calls back at a loss and sell new covered calls, or just eat it and be like, okay, you beat me, but I got a nice profit out of it. But for Tesla, yeah. Like my bread and butter, that's our bread and butter. Like,
exactly.
We understand that so well that like, that's the only company I buy long-term leaks in, because I'm confident that like, this is about to transform. Like, NVIDIA is great. Palantir, I don't study it enough. I don't really understand the business model to buy long-term call options. I mean, I've been wrong, but I just haven't played in that game. I don't understand. But also you can say the same about other stocks that I didn't understand, like that. Luckily I didn't buy long-term calls in, because it turned out those stocks were just overvalued at the time, you know? So Roku or whatever, you know, there's a lot of stocks that like ARK Invest, like all that, you know, they talk up all their stocks and they believe in all their stocks. They do the research. But if I don't personally do the research myself, I'm not comfortable buying the long-term leaps. Only Tesla, because I studied it so much. I know it's about to transform everything. And so to me, it just seems like this is very likely. I have a lot of conviction in that it's going to transform transportation very shortly and be revalued into something different. You know, so the long-term call options for me is like a great way to not just beat the market, but to 10x the market, you know? So it's like a life-changing event if you do it right, but it can, you know, it can also lose it all, obviously, too. So that's why I say, just for me, it's like a portion of my money. I keep compartmentalized over here. Like, I'm okay with losing if I was wrong, you know?
Yeah. So let me pick your brain on this for the last 10 minutes. So one of the guests we've had that I've been listening to quite a bit is Chris Camillo. I don't know if you're familiar with, but Chris Camillo, he is huge on the human or robot starting to become priced into the market. So maybe not this year, maybe not next, but in the upcoming like time period, similar to what we think the robotaxi is gonna do. Like he is way like not. He's not following the robotaxi stuff because he thinks that the transportation modality doesn't have nearly as much upside because of fleet management, et cetera, et cetera. But from a human or robot perspective, he thinks, I mean, like we do, that it's transformational, but that the market will start pricing it in the next year or so, right? Like they're going to see that they're going to have their aha moment. And his argument is like, this is a multi-decatrillion dollar TAM that has zero valuation in the market right now, and the only public play that you can use to get into that world is Tesla. And he thinks that there's going to be a gigantic amount of money flowing into Tesla, not to price robotaxi, but to price human or robot. And so I'm curious to get your take, or y'all's take, really. Is like, what do you think about that? Do you like, have we thought about that lever? Have we thought about that sort of becoming like coming to fruition? Is the robotaxi kind of a red herring? Is it really human or robot? Does it take only Tesla operating 100 robots in their factories, doing actual work, and it showing up, however small, but it's saying, yo, look at my COGS going down. You know, we had a COGS contribution of, I don't know, 2% of, you know, of for the same task. We did it for 2% less or 10% less or 15% less with the bot versus human labor. Like, does that then scale to 10 million robots and all of a sudden market's going to be like, yo, holy shit. Like, I'm curious to get y'all's thought on that.
I'll start. Oh, you start, Hans. You go.
Yeah, just briefly, because I think that there's a real chance here that if, you know, it really depends on how the progress of robotaxi is going. Because if Tesla launches the robotaxi network and the rollout is slow and it's kind of lackluster and doesn't exceed expectations and, you know, all these promises kind of feel like they haven't been met, much less exceeded, then that will be a complete downer for the humanoid robot story arc. But if on the flip side, we are blowing through people's expectations with the robotaxi, then it's basically like a multiplier on the Elon Musk option of, holy shit, this guy can make AI powered robotics in the real world into, you know, magic money printing machines to the moon.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think we're all love the humanoid robot. That's the huge destiny of where Tesla is going to head ultimately. But between that and where we are today is the robotaxi success and rollout. And that's what's going to make the stock overshoot what a robotaxi, you know, $3 to $5 trillion market cap company should be worth. And it maybe overshoots to $5 or $6 or $7 trillion mark. You know, like, let's say you'd model the robotaxi in the US and they model like, oh, it should only be worth with a 30 multiple, $2.8 trillion. How is it worth $5 trillion? And the reason it's going to be worth $5 trillion market cap is because everyone's going to be betting on the humanoid robot at that point. And the humanoid robot isn't really going to take effect, in my opinion, in the real world until 2028, 29 or 30, maybe 31 with latest. So between now and then, you're going to have this robotaxi real world rollout in 26, 27. That's going to like transform the market cap right now to this first next leg of, you know, 3 trillion market cap, something like that. Maybe it'll overshoot to 5 trillion because everyone's got their eyes on now on the story of the humanoid. And everyone's going to say it's over expensive for just a robotaxi maker. Just like we're overshot just being the mammoth EV producer, profitable car company with 25% gross margins. It overshot that originally to like a $1 trillion market cap. We justified it by saying, well, the robotaxi business is right around the corner, but that was, we didn't know it was 5 years away still. We thought it was like a year or two away still, you know?
So my opposite take of that is that Tesla had a $50 billion valuation and they were selling 20,000 cars a year. So why can't the same thing happen with the humanoid robot? Like how far away is Tesla from manufacturing the equivalent of 20,000 Model S's with the humanoid robots? Do we really think that's 2029?
Well, so say it again, Farza, what's the premise here?
So like Tesla only needed a small fraction of what the market, like they only needed a small fraction of the total like production for them to get the value, like you said, like it ran ahead. The market ran ahead and they priced a $50 billion valuation on the company when it was at $300 and they were producing 20,000 cars a year, 50,000 cars a year or whatever. Okay. What is the equivalent of the humanoid robot story for the market to do the same exact thing? How many robots do they need to see? Do they need to see 100,000? Like, do we think that's a 2028 timeline, 2029 timeline? I guess what I'm saying is in the same way that the market might overvalue the robotaxi, right? Why can't the same exact thing happen with the humanoid robot? You know, and so how many humanoid robots do we need?
Yeah,
you know, because it's like nobody's really making them. If you really think, there's no useful humanoid robots, but a useful humanoid robot is a function of the brain, and there's literally only one player that has a brain that I know of, right? And so, do we really think the brain is 3 years away from the humanoid robot doing something useful? Because you think about like you tier the most simple, most valuable to the most complex, least valuable, there is a lot of dumb, easy tasks that are worth a lot in this day and age. And the reason why people don't do it is because it's literally soul crushing. That feels like the perfect place for a human robot to jump in. And from a development standpoint, you would need, in theory, the least amount of intelligence. Like if you stratify the IQ necessary for jobs, most of them are on the low side. They're in the 70 yeah. or less, right?
Like, as you were saying. So like the spectrum, like we talked about right now, like I think you'll have ARK Invest and Ron Barron and a few others maybe say, oh, it should be a $10 trillion market cap company right now. Look, they already have 1,000 humanoids working in their factory. They're selling a couple dozen to this company and this company in trials that are going to last like a year, you know, and it's already productive. And that's why it's going to be worth $5 trillion or $4 trillion instead of $2 or $3 trillion from just the robotaxi business alone. So once they are beyond that in the next iteration where they're actually delivering tens of thousands of humanoids to external clients, that's when it maybe jumps up to like, you know, to the next level, possibly, you know, in my opinion, to the 5 to 10 trillion, you know, 10 trillion market cap, you know, type of company that we're all waiting on in the future. So I do think that that's gravy. That would be great if it happened in 2027, 2020. I think it'll be more like 2028, 2029, 2030 when that actual, like, you know, comes to be, because everything's just slow. He's optimistic about timelines. I can't wait to see the optimists like working in the Tesla factory, but it might be like a year or two of like trying it out in the factory before they give it to the first customers, you know? So maybe they can ramp up production really fast theoretically, but there's just, it's going to be a lot of kinks to work out. Just like full self-driving, theoretically, we thought they could turn it on back in 2018 or 19, you know? But it's been many kinks to work out to get it to where it is today for the proper rollout, you know?
Okay, so let me give you another one. Figure is worth $40 billion today.
Yeah.
Tesla doesn't seem to have any valuation.
Figure is also not publicly traded. If it was publicly traded, I'd short it for sure versus Tesla. I'd do like a pair.
But that's my point. But even if it's privately traded, right, they have a $40 billion valuation for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that means that there's at least some sort of market force that's trying to price this product. And in theory, if the company that has all the scale in the world to get 10, 20, 30, 40, 50x of the production capacity that Figure has, they seem to have a $0 valuation for the humanoid robot, right? Because they were worth $1 trillion before the humanoid robot even came out, right? Where they had the dancing guy. And now that they have Optimus Gen 2, Optimus Gen 3, and all this stuff, it hasn't done jack shit. So like, where is that valuation, right? Like, even if it's in the, let's say the private market right now, it's getting even if they're getting 2x sort of bonus multiple or whatever, just because they're a private company versus public or whatever. Like, that's still valuation that's not being tied to the stock. It's like, it's literally zero. That's what it seems like anyway. I don't know if I'm like being too optimistic or not, but that's what it feels like.
What do you think, Hans?
Yeah, I think it's hard when you're talking about a startup that has no business that might have a business. It's easy to, you know, have valuations obviously run ahead of cash flow compared to Tesla, where it is a big mature company. So not only is it in the public market, but it's earning, you know, tons and tons of free cash flow. And so they're just judged on completely different bases. So that makes it hard. Figure has, you know, done some pretty impressive demos. Whether the technology is real, I think that is a big question mark.
Yeah.
But they, you know, I think one of the reasons that they have such a high valuation is because I don't think it's that hard for these private investors to do channel checks of people who are interested in buying the Figure robots. And so when they, you know, call around all their CEO buddies, hey, you know, GM, hey Ford, hey General Mills, like, if you could buy 1,000 of these today at this price, would you buy it? And they're like, fuck yeah, I'd buy that in a heartbeat. And so I think, you know, private investors are giving it that valuation because they can validate the fact that the TAM is there. And so then it's just like pricing, what is the risk of whether or not Figure can capture, you know, some portion of that TAM.
Yeah. And it's all ultimately going to be about the manufacturing. Figure has no idea how to manufacture, you know, like they can create these science experiments where there's these robots that, you know, legitimately could do it, but they're never going to build thousands of them. In my opinion, they might build like, you know, their production lines are going to be all a big mess. You know, Tesla is the best at manufacturing in the world, you know, and they can manufacture, and that's what differentiates them. And to me, Figure is always going to seem too expensive for Microsoft or someone else to buy them, which is kind of like, you know, if they were valued at $5 or $10 billion on the private market, maybe Microsoft would buy them and infuse a ton of capital just to figure out the manufacturing, you know. But because they're valued at $40 billion, they're unfortunately not going to get bought by some bigger behemoth that's going to be able to, you know, spend a ton of capital to help them manufacture at scale. So Figure's kind of screwed, just like Rivian was screwed. To me, Figure is sort of like the Rivian. They're going to have a seemingly high valuation until they go public, and then they're going to be shorted the crap out of it and go down to $12 a share, be worth like $5 or $10 billion, you know, maybe $15 billion. And they're still going to be a little too expensive to buy for some bigger player, I think. So it's really, at that point, it's going to be all, you're going to have Chinese manufacturers and Tesla. That's what it's going to be. And it's going to be Tesla is at the top with manufacturing above even the Chinese manufacturers, but China is not far behind. And it's going to be a point where I feel like Tesla is going to become, you know, if there was a company to be nationalized in the U.S., it would be Tesla with all of its manufacturing prowess in this industry. So that's a good thing, actually, for the market valuation, because I think it'll stay in, you know, we're never going to nationalize a Tesla, for example, in my opinion. So it's just going to have this rich valuation that's going to just produce tons of cars and humanoids And then you'll have the figures, Aptronic, maybe Amazon will get into the, Amazon might be actually the next competitor. They, you know, NVIDIA will do their thing. So and that's outside of China. So I do think that Figure is a nice science. They're good at marketing themselves to investors right now, and they have cool videos. But the founder, I have question marks about Brett Adcock, to be honest. So I think he's a big seller of, like, you know, of ideas, but
of
not,
the stock.
Yeah. But not a master of executing in terms of, like, the hardest thing, which is the production, the manufacturing.
Yeah. I think your point about Amazon and then NVIDIA being, you know, huge players in this space is really important. I think people just don't appreciate how much money and time and effort and scale Amazon has invested in robotics. And they obviously have huge use cases and they're doing a lot of automation work already. And as that gets smarter and smarter, they're definitely going to, you know, be national champions in this space, you know, alongside Tesla. And one of the other partnerships that caught my notice this week was Palantir partnering with xAI to deliver AI-powered workflows to one of the big financial firms. And I just think it's interesting to see an actual partnership between an Elon company and Palantir. And I could potentially foresee, you know, a role for Palantir to play within enterprises to help integrate the Optimus robots into other people's businesses. You know, like Tesla is obviously going to be super easy to integrate Optimus bots into all of Tesla software ecosystem. I don't think that Tesla's really going to want to do the hard work of creating a general interface that's easy to adopt into other people's IT infrastructure. And so I think there's, like, that's the place that Palantir plays directly. And so, yeah, I think that, you know, there could be a cool partnership for Palantir to help facilitate the adoption of these robots from a overall software ecosystem perspective.
Okay. Anything else we want to hit before we wrap this sucker up?
Yeah, I would just say the humanoid robot, the reason why Tesla is so far, not just manufacturing, but they own the stack from the brains to the, you know, supply chain to the batteries to the actuators to the manufacturing. They just own the vertical stack. They're just perfectly positioned to take that industry over. And there's no competitor in the West, in my opinion, for that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Super interesting. Thank you, Amit. Yeah. Stick around here. We're going to end recording and then let's.